Banks, who were desperately trying to get their MBS inventory off their books, were still issuing similar CDOs at par. The TABX made it impossible for the banks to continue this charade. I don't recall what precipitated the tsunami, but at the beginning of August there was a wave of risk reduction, and everyone wanted to own the CDS protection that we held. When we liquidated in August 2007, we had positions that were marked at $50,000 on Friday's close and that we sold for $4.5 million on Monday. What other types of trades haven't we discussed? We love trades that appear to be approaching limits, trades that are so close to their absolute limit that they have tremendous asymmetry. Some examples are CDS protection on European banks in 2007 for 3 basis points and CDS on the ABX index for 9 basis points. The CDO trade also had the characteristic of being near a loss limit, but was special because of our high conviction for a large profit potential. Any others? We also look for trades where the market price level itself implies asymmetry. A good example is the Korean stock market in 2005, a situation in which we did a ton of work and ended up having conviction that the entire market was mispriced. Sometime in 2003 or 2004, it came to our attention that listed companies in South Korea looked very underpriced based on the fundamentals. Whereas all the other Asian markets that had tanked in 1997 during the currency crisis had subsequently recovered, South Korea continued to languish. It was not clear why this should be the case, especially since it appeared that South Korea had done a better job than any of its neighbors in adopting all the fiscal and market reforms imposed after the crisis. Specifically, South Korea had complied with all the terms of the emergency IMF loan, including austerity measures, and had overhauled security laws and regulation to a level that was on par with the U.S. South Korea already had a deep cultural respect for the rule of law, with lots of precedent for enforcing private property rights. Despite all of these positive changes, Korean equities traded at an increasing discount to the rest of Asia, so we spent a lot of time trying to figure out whether there was a good explanation for this apparent anomaly. Our model is to always find experts in the domain, river guides, so to speak. We developed a close relationship with a scion of the family controlling one of Korea's largest consumer electronics companies. He is an American, but was nevertheless very much an insider who gave us great access. We got our fingernails dirty. I probably traveled to Korea 10 times in the space of 18 months. We met lots of people on the buy side, the sell side, and in industry. We hired an undergrad from Berkeley who had recently immigrated from Korea. He did a lot of Korean to English translations of financial statements. After all this research, we became convinced that the logic for why Korea was cheap was circular. Korea was cheap because it had consistently been cheap. For several years, Korean companies that generated steady and impressive cash flows kept getting cheaper. Investors who had bought Korea earlier as a value trade had gotten burned, even though it seemed like their thesis was sound. By the time we arrived at the scene, there were lots of companies trading at substantial negative enterprise values. A negative enterprise value implies that the market is assigning a negative value to the company, excluding its cash assets and debts. There were companies with market caps of $300 million, no debt, and $550 million cash on the balance sheet, which was expected to increase to $650 million in the following year. In this case, there was tremendous asymmetry simply because these companies had nowhere to go but up.
What got the market to realize value eventually?
The passage of time. The inexorable accumulation of profits can only be ignored for so long until it acts as a catalyst for higher prices.
You talked earlier about how most of your trade ideas don't work out once you do the deep research. Can you give me an example of how research disproved what you thought was a great idea at the outset?
A perfect recent example was related to our hypothesis that the nonlinear impact of increasing coal imports by China could create a trading opportunity. China is by far the world's largest consumer and producer of thermal coal, accounting for about 50% of global activity. The market has grown at roughly 10% per year for decades now, which is in line with long-term GDP growth. Unlike most other commodities, which it must import, China has abundant physical reserves of coal. Demand growth has been consistently supplied by increased domestic production, with small residual surplus that was exported. So despite being the world's largest market by far, at roughly 3 billion tons per year, China's coal market operated essentially as a closed system. We noticed, however, that there was a strong trend in the export-import balance. China had gone from being a net exporter to a net importer, and the pace of this trend shift was accelerating. It had taken nearly a decade for net exports to drop from roughly 100 million tons to zero at the end of 2008. Yet it took only a year to cover the same ground in the other direction. By 2010, net imports were 150 million tons. Evidence that China was having major difficulties in expanding coal production at anywhere near the rate of its annual consumption increase reinforced the trend we were seeing in imports. If China needed to source 10% of its demand from international markets, total seaborne coal volume would have to jump over 50%. Our initial hypothesis was that China's thermal coal imports were likely to provide a secular tailwind to international thermal coal markets. Our next step was to look at ways to express the trade. We settled on dry bulk freight as the most levered way to take exposure to increasing seaborne coal volume. The early indicators were promising, given that the shipping companies we looked at seemed to be trading at depressed multiples of cash flows, despite a healthy rebound in freight volumes and dry bulk rates since the advent of the global recession in 2008. We expected to see rapidly growing dry bulk demand outstripping growth in supply, which we speculated had dropped off significantly due to the global recession. The picture that came up into focus, however, made it clear that our intuition had been completely wrong. It turned out that the supply pinch we expected to see had actually occurred several years earlier in connection with rising emerging market imports of commodities, such as iron ore. High freight rates had sparked a shipbuilding boom in the 3 to 4 years preceding the financial crisis. In 2010, new capsized freighters hitting the water equaled almost 20% of the global installed base. Fleet capacity is on track to increase by a similar amount in 2011. We concluded that even if China had to source 100% of its marginal growth through seaborne freight markets, there was no way demand could come close to absorbing the dry bulk capacity coming online.
So, ironically, you were looking at the dry bulk shippers as a potential buy, but once you dug into the fundamentals, you concluded they were actually a sell.
Yes, and not only a sell, but our highest conviction short trade in 2011.
Did you then go short the dry bulk shippers?
It is hard to see any circumstances in which we would go outright short a stock. Your gain is limited, your loss is unlimited, and your exposure grows as you are wrong. Instead, we bought out-of-the-money puts on some of the dry bulk ship operators. When rising implied volatilities made those premiums prohibitively expensive, we shifted toward in-the-money puts to reduce the time value decay.
There are five main pillars to Mai's investment strategy. 1. Find mispricings in a theoretically priced world. Mai seeks to identify trade opportunities that arise because prices, particularly for derivatives, are based on one of a number of standard pricing assumptions that may be entirely inappropriate based on the specific circumstances applicable to the given market. When these assumptions are unwarranted, they create mispricings and trading opportunities. 2. Select trades in which the probabilities appear to be significantly skewed to a positive outcome. As a general rule of thumb, Cornwall requires that the estimated gain if the trade succeeds multiplied by the probability of a positive outcome must be at least twice as large as the estimated loss if the trade fails, multiplied by the probability of a negative outcome. Of course, these gain and loss amounts and their respective probabilities must be based on subjective estimates. Nonetheless, the key point is that the probability-weighted gain must be lopsided relative to the probability-weighted loss. The rigorous standard for qualifying trades will lead to a concentrated portfolio. Typically, Mai will have only 15 to 20 independent risks, consisting of one or more separate trades, at any one time. This concentrated portfolio approach should not be confused with the proverbial "put all your eggs in one basket, but watch that basket very closely." The important distinction is that although Mai's portfolio is very concentrated, the asymmetric construction of his trades assures that the downside is always severely constrained if he is wrong. 3. Implement trades asymmetrically. Mai structures trades so that the downside is severely limited, while the upside is open-ended. One common way of achieving this type of return/risk profile is by being a buyer of options. Of course, only at those times when a mispricing is identified. 4. Wait for high conviction trades. Mai is perfectly content to stay on the sidelines and do absolutely nothing until there is a trade opportunity that meets his guidelines. Having the patience to wait for high expected value trades greatly enhances the return/risk of individual trades. 5. Use cash to target portfolio risk. Because most of the trades in the portfolio are derivatives, which require much smaller cash outlays than outright positions, Mai will hold a large cash component in the portfolio, typically 50-80%. By increasing or decreasing this cash component, Mai can target his desired portfolio risk level. Prices for derivatives, such as options, are determined by pricing models that embed certain assumptions. These models are used because they generally provide reasonably good approximations. The assumptions these models are based on, however, are sometimes inappropriate for a market given the specific prevailing fundamentals. The acceptance of these assumptions as being universally applicable, when in reality they are not, leads to trading opportunities. Mai identified 5 generally accepted assumptions that sometimes are invalid. 1. Prices are normally distributed. Options are priced based on the assumption of a normal distribution, which effectively implies that future prices near the current level are most probable and that probabilities drop steeply for prices further removed from current levels. In some instances, however, large price moves are much more likely than implied by the normal distribution. Consider, for example, Mai's comments regarding Capital One. The odds that the stock would still be near $30 in 2 years seem vanishingly small. Either the company would be vindicated or it would go under. In such circumstances, options priced in line with option pricing models will be severely mispriced. Specifically, out-of-the-money options will be priced far too cheaply. These mispricings can create profit opportunities. If the probability of a large price move is much greater than normal, as was the case with Capital One, then out-of-the-money options can provide a significant probability of gain while being priced consistent with long-shot probabilities. Another implication of the normal distribution assumption is that it is always equally likely for prices to go up X percent as down X percent. Although this assumption may often be a reasonable approximation, there are times when it is far more likely for a market to go up by a given percentage than down by the same amount or vice versa. A good example of such an asymmetric price outlook was the Korean stock market when Mai implemented his long position. At the time, the market was not only severely undervalued relative to other Asian markets, but prices were so low that many companies had market capitalizations that were less than their net cash balances. That is, the companies were effectively being valued at less than zero. In such circumstances, the odds of a large price advance are significantly greater than the odds of an equivalent price decline. There is an important corollary here. The contention by many academics that the market price is always right is inconsistent with the empirical evidence. There are times when the market price is clearly wrong, and these situations provide major trade opportunities. 2. The forward price is a perfect predictor of the future mean. This assumption implies that options will be priced with probabilities centered at the corresponding forward price. Sometimes, however, when the forward price is well removed from the current price, it may not be reasonable to assume that a price change equal to the difference between the forward and spot price is the most likely market outcome. Frequently, there may be good reason to assume that some price between the forward and spot price is more likely than the forward price. If this is true, out-of-the-money options, puts if the forward price is higher and calls if it is lower, may be underpriced. The Brazilian interest rate Mai described provided a good example of such an opportunity. 3. Volatility scales with the square root of time. This assumption, which is embedded in option pricing, may be reasonable for shorter time intervals. For longer time periods, however, this volatility assumption may understate potential volatility, particularly if current volatility is low, for two reasons. First, the longer the time period, the more likely volatility will revert to the mean from current low levels. Second, longer periods allow for more opportunity for trends to result in larger price moves than implied by the volatility assumption. 4. The trend can be ignored in the volatility calculation. Option pricing models gauge the probability of price moves of a given magnitude based on volatility and time. Trend is not a part of the calculation. The implicit assumption is that the direction of daily price changes is random. Consequently, a trending market can result in price moves that would be deemed improbable by the pricing model. If there is a reason to expect a trend, then out-of-the-money options are likely to be underpriced. My's Canadian dollar option trade was based on this premise. 5. Current correlations are good predictors of future correlations. Some market correlations tend to be fairly consistent, e.g. gold and platinum tend to be positively correlated over the broad spectrum of time. While other market pairs may exhibit variable correlation patterns, e.g. the Australian dollar and Swiss franc that were part of Mai's worst of basket trade. Correlation-based trades will tend to assume future correlation equal to the correlation in the past look-back period. Such an assumption may often be invalid for markets that have variable correlation patterns. One of the great misconceptions of the investing public is equating risk with volatility, which is wrong-headed on multiple grounds. First, frequently, the most important risks don't show up in the track record and hence are not reflected by volatility. For example, a portfolio of illiquid positions held during a risk-on period may have low volatility, but large risk if market sentiment shifts to risk-off. The other side of the coin is that sometimes volatility can be high because of abrupt large gains, but the theoretical risk of the investment is limited. My strategy provides a good example of an investment approach that has high volatility and constrained risk. My's track record shows a lot of volatility because of a predilection to large gains, not a characteristic most investors would associate with risk or consider undesirable. Although the volatility is very high, the risk is tightly controlled because trades are structured to be asymmetric. The maximum possible loss on each trade is well defined and far smaller than the potential gain. My's investment approach demonstrates the principle that high volatility does not necessarily imply high risk. Flexibility is one of the hallmarks of market wizards. My routinely changes his view as dictated by the research. His trade in dry bulk shippers provides a perfect example. He started off with the idea that these companies were a buy, but ended up taking the exact opposite exposure when his research indicated that his initial premise had been entirely erroneous. Good traders get out of a position when they realize they have made a mistake. Great traders are capable of taking the opposite position when they realize their original concept was dead wrong. Chapter 8. Michael Platt, The Art and Science of Risk Control. Michael Platt achieved career clarity at an early age. "I have had a very easy life," he says, "because I never had to think about what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a trader from when I was 12, and I started when I was 13. Platt continued to successfully trade stocks through high school and university with one major exception. His stock account lost half its value in a single day, the crash of October 19, 1987. This episode was the first and last time Platt experienced a large percentage loss. After graduating from the London School of Economics in 1991, Platt joined J.P. Morgan, where he had an extremely profitable 8-year career, trading a wide range of fixed income derivatives. His success at the firm led to repeated promotions, culminating with his appointment as managing director in London, with the responsibility of heading up proprietary relative value trading. Platt left J.P. Morgan in 2000, along with William Reeves, to co-found Bluecrest. The firm has been extremely successful, growing to close to $29 billion in assets under management and nearly 400 staff by early 2012. The majority of assets are in two programs, a discretionary strategy headed by Michael Platt, and a systematic trend-following strategy headed by Lita Braga, who joined the firm in 2001. The discretionary trading strategy has achieved an average annual compounded net return of just under 14%. The hallmark of Bluecrest performance is not its return, but rather its extraordinary risk control. In 11 years of operation, the discretionary strategy's largest peak-to-trough equity drawdown has been under 5%. Keep in mind, this track record includes the 2008 financial meltdown, in which many hedge funds witnessed single days with larger drawdowns. The return/risk of the discretionary strategy headed by Platt is off the charts with a gain-to-pain ratio of 5.6. The gain-to-pain ratio is a loss-based, as opposed to a volatility-based, return/risk measure. The consistent and extended low-risk numbers achieved by Bluecrest's discretionary strategy are not a matter of chance. Platt is obsessive about risk control. It permeates his own trading and the design of every aspect of the strategy. The discretionary strategy has kept losses remarkably low through a three-tiered process of combining broad diversification, seven teams trading different strategies and sectors, extreme tight reins on the losses of individual traders, and oversight by a seven-person risk management team. Platt is really serious about risk control. I met Platt at the firm's Geneva office. We talked in a conference room that was memorable for its unusual color, orange. When discussing trading strategies, Platt speaks at a speed that is somewhere between a rushed New Yorker and the fast-talking executive in the famous FedEx commercial. When the topic of conversation is a four-legged fixed income trade, keeping up with Platt can be a challenge. How did you get interested in markets? I have always liked puzzles. When I was 10 years old, my dad gave me a Rubik's Cube, and 36 hours later, I could do it from any position in under 1 minute. I always regarded financial markets as the ultimate puzzle because everyone is trying to solve it, and infinite wealth lies at the end of solving it. When you are solving any puzzle, you have to start off from the perspective, what do I know for sure? Do I have any bedrock to start off my analysis? It's shocking how little you know for certain in financial markets. One of the only things I could say with certainty was that markets trend because I can observe trends in any financial market, in any time era. You could go back 150 years in cotton futures, and there are trends everywhere. The same is true for equities, bonds, short-term rates, everything. It seems illogical that markets trend. Markets should discount all information and then be static, waiting for the next piece of information before changing price level. But that is not what they do. And the reason they trend is because our minds just don't work properly. We make an estimation of the future based on all the knowledge we have of the past at the current moment. We remember the past in bullet point form. We'll never remember this conversation verbatim. We'll remember bullet points. All the things that are happening currently, we have a high level of detail on because they are instantaneous and all around us. It turns out that when you recall the past, you have lots of gaps because you only retain an edited summary of it. You fill in those gaps the same way you fill in a wall with plaster. The material with which you fill in the gaps in your past recollections is called today. So how you feel today, whatever you are thinking today, whatever is going on today, is what you're going to use to fill in the gaps in the past. It is well known that people misremember the past. There's a famous experiment in which about 200 people watch a slide sequence of a car going to the end of a street, turning right, and then hitting a pedestrian. Half the group sees slides with a stop sign at the end of the street, and the other half see a similar set of slides with a yield sign. The subjects are then asked some questions about what they saw. Within each group, half the subjects are asked one question that refers to a stop sign, while the other half are asked the same question with a reference to a yield sign. All the participants are then shown two nearly identical slides and asked to pick the slide they saw. The only difference between the two slides is that one has a stop sign and the other a yield sign. A large majority of the people who were asked a question that contradicted what they saw, a reference to a stop sign when they saw a yield sign, or vice versa, misidentified the slide they actually saw. The point is that once they are presented with contradictory information, the majority of people misremember something that they watched only a few moments ago, because they use the more recent information to fill in what they can't remember exactly, or at least are not 100% sure of. They are filling in the gaps in their bullet point memory of the past with information from the current moment. If the market is going up today, your forecast is going to be that it will continue going up because it is how you feel at the moment that is the most important thing. Today becomes how you felt in the past because you misremember. So everything is about today. If it is going up today, it will go up tomorrow. In this sense, financial markets become self-referential. I would have a different explanation of why markets trend. I believe markets trend because there is some important underlying change in fundamentals that has not been adequately discounted, or sometimes markets trend because they anticipate such a fundamental change. But any major trend has some fundamental catalyst. Markets may initially trend for fundamental reasons, but prices overshoot by ludicrous amounts. At some point, prices go up today simply because they went up yesterday. Okay, you know that markets trend. What else do you know for certain? You also know that diversification works. That is what the systematic trend-following strategy is built on. Markets trend and diversification works. It doesn't have any economic information. But that leaves open two questions. How do you accurately identify trends without being overly subject to whipsaws? And how have you managed to keep risks so constrained? First, the systematic trend-following strategy trades over 150 markets. Second, the systematic team looks at past correlations in weighting those markets. Currently, because of the whole risk-on, risk-off culture that has developed, diversification is quite hard to get. When I first started trading about 20 years ago, U.S. and European bond markets weren't really that correlated. Now, these markets move together tick by tick.
So how do you get diversification when you have such extreme correlation?
You have problems getting it. Recently, everything works or everything doesn't work. For example, we have had periods where everything worked for the systematic trend-following strategy, and we made $1 billion.
It's all really one trade, isn't it?
Well, that's exactly my point. How then do you control the risk? How do you protect yourself against a market reversal where everything then goes against you at the same time?
There are lots of ways the program deals with this problem, but the main method is using a response curve, which means that when a trend gets really overextended, our system will liquidate the position, and when the market reverses, it will reinstate it. That part is not really secret. We share that information with our investors. But how we do it, how we determine when a market is overextended, and how we execute trading out of and back into positions, that is a matter of an insane amount of mathematical research, and of course is proprietary. The systematic team is continually researching the correlation between markets, modeling markets versus other markets, and pursuing virtually every angle of analysis you can think of. The program has literally millions of lines of code. It's the best you can do with a bunch of markets that are reasonably correlated now. The biggest protection we have is liquidating out of overextended trends. If the trend goes further still, too bad. More often than not, it is a good decision. It saves your bacon on the big reversals.
The real Achilles heel in systematic trend following is if you get whipsaw markets. How has your systematic trend following strategy avoided getting hit by more significant drawdowns during these types of markets?
Our system will tend to keep the position small if the trend is perceived as being weak.
Is your systematic trend following strategy fully defined, or is it changed over time?
The strategy is always changing. It is a research war. Lita has built a phenomenal, talented team that is constantly seeking to improve our strategy.
Is the implication that if you stay with a static system, eventually it will degrade?
Yes, I hear that. Platt names a well-known CTA with a long track record. Original system is now insanely volatile and unprofitable.
On a recent plane trip, I read The Complete Turtle Trader by Michael Koval, a book about the group of traders originally trained by Richard Dennis and Bill Eckhart, using a variation of a simple breakout system, originally developed by Richard Donchian. In the book, Koval details the actual rules of the once secret system. Now, I'm pretty familiar with breakout systems, and I know from computer testing that they don't work all that well. They make moderate returns with lots of volatility. I, therefore, was quite curious to see what modifications the turtle system made to transform what I knew to be a mediocre system into an effective one. So, as I read the book, I jotted down any rules that were modifications of a basic breakout system. When I looked at these modifications, none of them seemed to be all that significant, and I couldn't understand how they could make such a big difference. At the end of the book, Koval provided an appendix containing the track records for many of the turtle traders. Throughout the book, he had mentioned one of these traders as being the best of the group. I checked the track record for this trader, which went back to the mid-1980s, and I saw lots of huge returns in the earlier years. Then I looked at just the last 8 years and mentally estimated that the average annual return during that period was maybe only 2% higher than the T-bill rate, but with substantial volatility. The whole great track record was really pre-late 1990s, and since then, the performance has degraded into mediocrity. I'm sure most investors don't look past the impressive total track record statistics and fail to realize that all the outperformance occurred well in the past, and that the more recent period statistics are radically different. We went off on a bit of a tangent. I asked you about how you got interested in the markets, and you told me about your interest in puzzles. But we never talked about how you actually first became involved in markets.
My grandmother traded equities. I got involved in stock trading through her. She was a long-term investor and did very well at it. She was a very strong woman. She wasn't interested in baking a cake for me. She was interested in what stock I wanted to buy or sell. I told my grandmother about a trust savings bank whose shares were going to be floated. It's going to be open at a premium, I told her, because they're going to sell it cheap so everyone buys the shares. She said, okay, then let's get involved. She asked me, how much do you want to buy? As much as I can, I told her.
She said, "Okay, I'll lend you the money." She lent me the cash, and I filled out the application forms, which were clearly in her name. We bought 500 pounds or 1,000 pounds of stock. I don't remember the exact amount. At 50 pence, and it opened at 99 pence.
How did you get the idea to buy the stock?
I read about it. When I was 12 or 13 years old, I got a copy of this magazine called Investor's Chronicle, which had interesting articles about the market, trading options, and lots of company analyses. I read it every week after that. By the time I was 14, I knew every single stat on every single company. At the time, the UK was going through a privatization phase, and I was just buying all the stocks when they went public and flipping them. I must have made 20,000 to 30,000 pounds.
This is all while you were still in high school?
Yes. When I was at university, I continued trading my own account. I got hammered in the stock market crash of 1987.
Tell me about that experience.
I woke up that Monday morning and glanced out the window. It looked like there was some sort of hurricane going on in London. Trees had been knocked down. The place had looked like a bomb site. I thought to myself, what a terrible morning. I turned on the radio, and that's when I heard the stock market was crashing.
How much of your money did you have invested at the time?
Oh, all of it. I had no understanding of proper diversification and money management at the time. By the time I got to check on prices, my account was down 50%. My broker was telling me, don't sell, don't sell.
So what did you do?
I sold it all. I just took the loss.
In that particular case, getting out turned out to be the wrong thing to do.
I thought to myself, I had 30,000 pounds, and now I have 15,000 pounds. I can still have a good time at university with that amount in the next few years.
That was it for how long?
Not very long. Soon after, I bought shares in a stock that had gotten crushed, which rebounded a lot. So I made some money back on that.
So far, we have only talked about the trend-following system. How much of Bluecrest's trading is systematic?
We run approximately $29 billion, updated as of end of 2011, which is about evenly divided between systematic and discretionary approaches. Interestingly, for the prior three calendar years, 2008 to 2010, we almost made identical returns in both systematic and discretionary strategies, but with a better Sharpe ratio on the human side.
Which markets are traded in the discretionary strategy?
The big three are fixed income, credit, and emerging markets.
What about equities?
We don't trade equities except for one small program.
Why not?
It's too qualitative. I prefer quantitative approaches.
Can't equities be quantitative?
We do have a small program, which is a systematic program trading single stocks. It is basically an intelligent market maker. It models the price of every stock, using all the other stock prices as the input. It looks for divergence. If, for example, Fidelity decides to liquidate a given stock, their selling will probably push the stock out of line with a basket of stocks. We will buy the stock and sell the basket, and we will do the same thing with other stocks.
So it is basically a statistical arbitrage approach.
Yes, it is. We have done a phenomenal amount of work on quantitatively selecting single stocks.
The implication of that is there have been a lot of dead ends.
Yes, there have been.
I recall that you did have another equity strategy at one time. What happened to it?
Yes, we did. It was a market-neutral strategy for investors who wanted the relative value approach in equities. It made money, but it wasn't top quartile. I want our products to be in the top 2 percentile, not in the bottom half. In August 2007, we had about $9 billion in gross exposure in this strategy. I am sitting there, and I see LIBOR suddenly jump 10 points. This had never happened in my trading career. I thought, this just feels very bad and scary.
10 basis points doesn't sound like that much.
Yes, but it was for no reason at all. I looked at some bank balance sheets, leverage statistics. One UK bank was 60 times leveraged. Its balance sheet was 7% of world GDP and over 150% of UK GDP. Banks wouldn't lend to each other because they had too much exposure. It didn't feel right. A couple of weeks later, I went to give a talk at an investor conference in Lugano. Whenever I give a talk on global markets, I never write anything down. I just speak off the cuff. As I am presenting the speech, I find myself giving this huge rant about how I believe there was going to be a global credit crunch. I said, asking people in the credit market how they feel is like asking someone who has jumped out of the 50th floor window how he feels as he passes floor 10. He is currently all right, but he's not going to be soon. I heard myself coming out with a stream of consciousness.
You didn't plan this talk?
I never plan talks. I went on and on about how the credit markets are ready to implode. There are about 200 people in the room. When I finished, there was dead silence. They really thought I had gone off the deep end.
What did you predict was going to happen?
I said there was going to be a total credit crunch, an equity market meltdown, and a flight to quality bonds.
Had you adjusted your portfolio to reflect these expectations?
No, it just dawned on me as I was giving the speech. I went back to the office and thought, $9 billion of stocks going into a credit crunch. I don't want any of this crap. I got the fund manager into my office and said, look, August was not that great. The strategy was down about 5% in August. I continued, honestly, I don't believe in this anymore. There's going to be a credit crunch, and the stuff you've got is going to be absolutely toxic. Let's shut the strategy down.
Even though it was market neutral?
Yes, because I was afraid of liquidity.
Actually, August 2007 was the month when many statistical arbitrage in some market-neutral funds got killed. A 5% loss for a market-neutral fund that month is not really that extreme.
I have no appetite for losses. Our discretionary strategy's worst peak-to-trough drawdown in over 10 years was less than 5%, and this strategy lost approximately 5% in 1 month. One thing that brings my blood to a boiling point is when an absolute return guy starts talking about his return relative to anything. My response was, you are not relative to anything, my friend. You can't be in the relative game just when it suits you, and in the absolute game just when it suits you. You are in the absolute return game, and the fact that you use the word relative means that I don't want you anymore.
What made you so convinced of an impending credit crunch?
It was just the huge excess leverage in the system everywhere you looked, and when LIBOR jumped by 10 basis points, it was like seeing the first crack.
What happened to LIBOR liquidity after that point?
It went straight down. The LIBOR-OIS spread started to widen.
What is the OIS?
The OIS is the overnight index swap, which is a weighted average of overnight lending rates. The LIBOR-OIS spread reflects the illiquidity premium. If you lend money for 90 days, you demand a premium because you can't get it right back. If I lend you cash for 90 days, I want to be paid more than if I lend it to you overnight. I could lend you money overnight for 90 days, but I have the option to break it at any time. If I give up my option to break the loan, I want to be compensated. The market price for the option to break, that is the LIBOR OIS spread, used to be almost nothing because people were so confident. Then suddenly, when liquidity dried up, the option to break was worth 200 basis points, and then more than 300 basis points. In fact, you couldn't even get 90-day money at the end. Anyway, when this crack appeared in the market, I knew I didn't want to have equity exposure. So during the next 6 weeks, we liquidated the entire $9 billion of exposure. The strategy was shut, and the money was sent back to investors. We watched the markets very carefully, and in early 2008, I transferred a vast proportion of the firm's money into 2-year treasury notes. I got rid of all the money market funds. I put all the traders into a wind-down of counterparty exposure. We dumped outright exposure to every bank possible and went maximum long fixed income. The systematic trend following strategy was consistently moving into a similar position. It started reversing from long to short in equities and commodities and going hugely long in fixed income. Again, it was all the same trade, wasn't it?
So when the market meltdown hit later in 2008, you were positioned perfectly.
In 2008, Bluecrest made the most amount of money for its investors in its history up to that point. Even though we were making loads of money, many of our investors redeemed simply because they couldn't get their cash from anyone else. We were making about $500 million a month, and in numerous months paying out about $1 billion. It was a bit depressing.
It hardly sounds depressing. The main thing is that you were making money when everyone else was losing. You didn't have to worry about the money. The money would always come back if you have the performance.
It did. Also, it helped a great deal that we didn't gate. When investors started returning to hedge funds, we got an unusually large share of the net investments. According to Deutsche Bank research in 2010, net inflows into hedge funds totaled $55 billion. We got $1.09 out of those inflows.
You not only did very well in 2008, but you also did well in 2009 when markets rebounded strongly. What were the trades that accounted for the 2009 gains?
We faded a lot of the very big call and put skews in the market. The out-of-the-money strikes were insanely expensive. so we shorted a lot out of the money options and protected ourselves with offsetting long positions in the at-the-money options. The tails were enormously fat because of what had happened in 2008. The break-even points on the shorts in the out-of-the-money strikes were so crazy that you needed to have another major crisis to come anywhere near losing money on the position. And I didn't think we were going to have another crisis 6 months after the 2008 crisis.
Generals fight the last war. Speculators trade the last market. How have you managed to keep your risk so incredibly restrained through all types of markets?
I talk about macro themes a lot because they are fun to talk about, but it is the risk management that is the most important thing. The risk control is all bottom up. I structure the business right from the get-go so that we would have lots of diversification. For example, on the fixed income side, I hire specialists. I have a specialist in Scandinavian rates, a specialist in the short end, a specialist in volatility surface arbitrage, a specialist in euro long-dated trading, an inflation specialist, and so on. They all get a capital allocation. Typically, I will hand out about $1.5 billion for every $1 billion we manage because people don't use their entire risk allocation all the time. I assume, on average, they will use about two-thirds. The deal is that if a trader loses 3%, he has to give me back half of his trading line. If he loses another 3% of the remaining half, that's it. His book is auctioned. All the traders are shown his book and take what they want into their own books, and anything that is left is liquidated.
What happens to the trader at that point? Is he out on the street?
It depends on how he reached his limit. I'm not a hard-nosed person. I don't say, you lost money, get out. It's possible someone gets caught in a storm. A trader might have some very reasonable Japanese positions on, and then there is a nuclear accident, and he loses a lot of money. We might recapitalize him, but it depends. It is also a matter of gut feel. How do I feel about the guy?
Is the 3% loss measured from the allocation starting level?
Yes, it is definitely not a trailing stop. We want people to scale down if they are getting it wrong and scale up if they are getting it right. If a guy has a $100 million allocation and makes $20 million, he then has $23 million to his stop point.
Do you move that stop up at any point?
No, it rebases annually.
So every January 1st, traders start off with the same 3% stop point?
Yes, unless they carry over some of their P&L. 1 year, one of my guys made about $500 million of profits. He was going to get a huge incentive check. I said to him, do you really want to be paid out on the entire $500 million? How about I pay you on $400 million and you carry over $100 million so you still have a big line? He said, yeah, that's cool, I'll do that. So he would have to lose that $100 million plus 3% of the new allocation before the first stop would kick in.
Your structure of cutting a trader's book on successive 3% losses builds asymmetry into the performance. The downside is limited, but the upside is unlimited. In fact, you are structuring traders like they are options.
Yes, completely.
In addition to the broad diversification and the tight 3%, 3%, two-tiered risk constraint on each trader, are there any other elements to the risk management strategy?
We have a 7-person risk management team.
What are they looking for?
The key thing they are monitoring for is a breakdown in correlation.
Wouldn't it be the other way around? Wouldn't higher correlation increase risk?
No, because most of our positions are spreads. So lower correlations would increase the risk of the position. The most dangerous risks are spread risks. If I assume that IBM and Dell have a 0.95 correlation, I can put on a large spread position with relatively small risk. But if the correlation drops to 0.50, I could be wiped out in 10 minutes. It is when the spread risks blow up that you find that you have much more risk than you thought. Controlling correlations is the key to managing risk. We look at risk in a whole range of different ways.
What else does the risk management team look for?
They stress test the positions for all sorts of historical scenarios. They also scan portfolios to search for any vulnerabilities in positions that could impact performance. They literally ask the traders, if you were going to drop $10 million, where would it come from? And the traders will know. A trader will often have some position in his book that is a bit spicy, and he will know what it is. So you just ask him to tell you. Most of what you get in the vulnerabilities and position reports, you already know anyway. We would hope that our risk monitoring systems would have caught 95% of it. It is just a last check.
Anything else on the risk side?
Being long volatility is great protection against all scenarios. Typically, we are neutral to long volatility, and I hate shorting out-of-the-money strikes. We made an exception in 2009 because, as we discussed earlier, the out-of-the-money options were very overpriced, and we hedged them with long in-the-money positions. I expected the out-of-the-money positions to roll off valueless, and they did.
You have picked a lot of traders in your career. What do you look for when you hire a trader?
I want market makers, people who know that anything can happen. The type of guy I don't want is an analyst who has never traded. The type of person who does a calculation on a computer, figures out where a market should be, puts on a big trade, gets caught up in it, and doesn't stop out. And the market is always wrong, he's not. Market makers know that the market is always right. You are wrong if you are losing money for any reason at all. Market makers have that drilled into their head. They know that value is irrelevant in times of market stress. It's all about positions. They understand that markets will trade against positions. They get it. It is built into their books. It colors the way they think. I look for the type of guy in London who gets up at 7 o'clock on Sunday morning when his kids are still in bed and logs onto a poker site so that he can pick off the U.S. drunks coming home on Saturday night. I hired a guy like that. He usually clears 5 or 10 grand every Sunday morning before breakfast, taking out the drunks playing poker, because they're not very good at it, but their confidence has gone up a lot. That's the type of guy you want. Someone who understands an edge. Analysts, on the other hand, don't think about anything else other than how smart they are.
But of course, on the systematic trend side, you would want analysts.
That's a completely different world. I'm talking about the human discretionary trading. I'm talking about a different type of analyst, market macro analysts who do their research and come up with a theory.
I can give great example to illustrate your point. I mention a particular hedge fund manager I know who I think is brilliant and who was early and right in calling major macro themes, yet did poorly trading off his correct ideas.
There are a lot of people like that. There are a lot of people that, if you listen to their ideas, you can make more money off their thinking than they can. I troll around. It's a treasure hunt for information. I talk to lots of people. Every now and then, someone says something, and I know I'm going to make much more money off of it than they will. There's a big difference between shooting wine glasses at 20 yards and shooting a wine glass pointing a gun back at you. I want guys who, when they put on a good trade, immediately start thinking about what they could put on against it. They just have the paranoia. Market makers get derailed in crises far less often than analysts. I hired an analyst one time who was a very smart guy. I probably made 50 times more money on his ideas than he did. I hired an economist once, which was the biggest mistake ever. He lasted only a few months. He was very dogmatic. He thought he was always right. The problem always comes down to ego. You find that analysts and economists have big egos, which just gets in the way of making money because they can never admit that they are wrong.
What percent of the people you give money to work out?
A very high percentage. Market makers are just reliable. One trader who didn't work out was the fixed income analyst I mentioned before, the only analyst I hired. I really liked him, and I made a lot of money on his ideas, but he couldn't keep his car on the road.
Maybe you should have kept him on just for his ideas.
I would actually have been happy to have him stay, but he just got too disillusioned. He decided he just wanted to be a school teacher and get some sense of accomplishment by doing social good.
So what was his failing? Did he get the trends right but couldn't trade?
He was very good at identifying relative value opportunities and mispricings, but he had no idea about macro. You can be as smart as you like about analyzing instruments, but there is no hedge against being wrong. If you think rates are going up when they're going down, I don't care what trade you've done, you're going to lose money. You might lose less if you've been particularly clever about how you implemented the trade, but you're still going to lose.
What other traders didn't work out?
There were 3 market makers we hired that didn't work out. One flatlined, he just became gun-shy and left. The other 2 lost money.
Was there anything different about the traders who didn't work out versus the majority who did?
Both the ex-market makers who blew up became way too invested in their positions. Their ego got in the way. They just didn't want to be wrong, and they stayed in their positions.
What about the firm's risk monitoring?
Well, they just hit their stops. I don't interfere with traders.
A trader is either a standalone producer or gone. If I start micromanaging a trader's position, it then becomes my position. Why then am I paying him such a large percentage of the incentive fee?
In your own trading book, what is the breakdown between directional and relative value trades?
It completely depends. Sometimes I have no directional trades on, and sometimes directional trades dominate my book. Basically, I like buying stuff cheap and selling it at fair value. How you implement a trade is critical. I develop a macro view about something, but then there are 20 different ways I can play it. The key question is, which way gives me the best risk/return ratio? My final trade is rarely going to be a straight long or short position.
How would you characterize yourself as a trader?
I don't have any tolerance for trading losses. I hate losing money more than anything. Losing money is what kills you. It is not the actual loss. It's the fact that it messes up your psychology. You lose the bullets in your gun. What happens is you put on a stupid trade, lose $20 million in 10 minutes, and take the trade off. You feel like an idiot, and you're not in the mood to put on anything else. Then the elephant walks past you while your gun's not loaded. It's amazing how annoyingly often that happens. In this game, you want to be there when the great trade comes along. It's the 80-20 rule of life. In trading, 80% of your profits come from 20% of your ideas.
How do you avoid or minimize losses?
I don't trade unless I've done all the work and really have a view. If I enter a trade, and the minute I put it on I feel uncomfortable, I will just turn around and get right out. Also, I look at each trade in my book every day and ask myself the question, would I enter this trade today at this price? If the answer is no, then the trade is gone. Most of the trades that I do stop myself out of, I stop out because of time rather than because of a loss. If I really love the trade and get strongly positioned, and then a month later it still hasn't moved, alarm bells start ringing in my head. I think to myself, that is a really great idea you have, but the market is just not playing ball.
What do you look for to make a trade?
There are three things you need to make money in a market. You need a decent fundamental story, a good trend that looks like it will carry on, and the market handling news the way you think it should. Bull markets ignore any bad news, and any good news is a reason for a further rally.
Can you think of an example where the market response to the news was counter to what you expected and impacted your trade?
In 2009, I was long 2-year notes, short 10-year notes 1 year forward, looking for the yield curve to widen, and a lot of news came out that I thought would hurt me. One news item after another, I saw the screen and thought, I'm going to get screwed in this position. But I didn't. After a number of these instances, I thought the yield curve just can't get any flatter no matter what comes out. So I quadrupled my position. It was a great trade. The spread went from 25 basis points to 210, although I got out at 110.
Any other examples where the market action was the catalyst for a trade?
When the whole debt fiasco in Europe started to unfold, the euro plunged from 1.45 to 1.19. Everyone was bearish, and so was I. I thought, I am in this trade. I have made a lot of money. It is going down to 1.00. I should increase my position. I had drunk the Kool-Aid along with everyone else. As I'm looking at the screen, the euro suddenly trades back up to 1.21. That should not have happened. The ex-market maker part of my brain starts thinking, everyone has the trade on. Everyone believes. Everyone who was long euro is now out. There is still a trade surplus. Wouldn't it just be a disaster for everyone if the euro suddenly went back up again?
Was there any news that triggered the rebound in the euro?
No, it was just the price action combined with the consensus. That was enough to get me out. I like to know what the consensus view is because you really do make the most money when the consensus shifts.
How do you get the consensus?
It is not easy to get. If you ask people their position, they're not exactly going to tell you, are they? My favorite question to ask people is, what is your opinion? The minute you ask people for their opinion, they feel important. If I ask a hedge fund manager for his opinion on where the 30-year bond will be trading in 3 months' time, and he starts talking about factors that will push interest rates up, I know that he is short bonds because the correlation between his 3-month forecast and his current position is going to be 100%. There is no doubt about that. If he was long, he would have picked some plausible story about why rates should go down. It's amazing how much information you can get about people's positions by simply asking them about their opinions.
Have there been any situations where the market abruptly reversed direction and you were positioned the wrong way in meaningful size? If so, how did you handle it?
I once went on a trip with ARK, which is a charity I sponsor, to help design a feeding program for children, which has turned out to be a great success, reaching 60,000 children. At the time, I had a massive long position in European interest rate futures. While I was on the flight to South Africa, the European Central Bank, ECB, hiked rates very unexpectedly. It was a massive hit. It was probably the only time I got an ECB call wrong. As soon as I landed, I got a phone call from an assistant telling me the ECB had just hiked rates and asking me what I wanted to do. "How much are we down?" I asked.
"About $70 million to $80 million," he answered. I said, "If they started hiking, they won't stop at 25 basis points. I can see this trade turning into a $250 million loss by week's end. Dump everything aggressively. Take the price to a place where it trades. When I am wrong, the only instinct I have is to get out. If I was thinking one way, and now I can see it was a real mistake, then I'm probably not the only person in shock, so I better be the first one to sell. I don't care what the price is. In this game, you have to have an option to keep 20% of your P&L this year, but you also want to own the serial option of being able to do that every year. You can't be blowing up."
What mistakes do you think traders make, not necessarily the traders working with you, that get them into trouble?
I think the two biggest mistakes traders make is that they don't do enough homework, and they are a bit too casual about risk.
Yes, I know you've heard it 1,000 times, but risk control really is critical to trading success. According to Platt, it is the most important thing. And Platt is a master of risk control. "I hate losing money more than anything," he says, and that aversion strongly colors his trading approach. The principle of minimizing losses permeates Platt's trading habits. Risk management begins with trade implementation. Platt will express a trading theme, say an expectation that interest rates will decrease, by implementing the trade in a way that minimizes risk relative to the same return potential. Thus, Platt will rarely implement directional trade ideas as outright long or short positions. He will be much more likely to use long options or complex spread structures that will provide equivalent return potential, but with theoretically constrained risk. Of course, Platt will strictly limit the maximum loss on any individual position, but he does not stop there. If he feels uncomfortable in a trade after he enters it, he will get right out. Most of the trades that Platt stops himself out of never get to their stop-loss points. If a trade does not work within a reasonable amount of time, Platt will just liquidate rather than give it room to his original stop point. Platt also reevaluates each of his positions daily and asks himself whether he would still place the same trade day. If not, he will liquidate it. Perhaps the most potent risk control Platt employs in Bluecrest's discretionary strategy is maintaining an extremely tight rein on what a trader can lose before capital is withdrawn. A mere 3% loss is enough to trigger a 50% reduction in a trader's allocation, and the same small additional percentage loss is all it takes to remove a trader's entire allocation. These rigid rules seek to prevent any trader from losing more than 5% of his initial stake. The combination of two successive 3% losses is less than a 5% loss because the second 3% loss is incurred only on 50% of the starting stake. In his own trading book, Platt is subject to the same rules as his traders, but he has never approached the 3% loss point. You would think that with such extreme loss limitations, it would be very difficult for individual traders, and in turn the strategy, to make much money. It seems that with only 3% leeway before their capital allocation is slashed, that traders would be risking too little on their trades to make much of a return. How then has the discretionary strategy managed to average nearly a 14% year net return? The key is that the 3% risk rule applies to a trader's starting stake. So certainly the rule encourages traders to be very cautious at the onset, being highly selective in their trades and tightly limiting the loss on any trade. But as traders get ahead, their cushion widens as trading gains augment the small initial 3% loss allowance. Once they are comfortably in the black, traders can take much more risk, thereby creating the potential to achieve large returns, despite the highly restrictive initial loss limitation. Essentially, the trader allocation risk control strategy assures capital preservation, while at the same time keeping upside potential open-ended by allowing greater risk-taking with profits. It is effectively an asymmetric risk management strategy. Risk control is important for many obvious reasons, which include avoiding account incapacitating losses,
minimizing emotional pain, and constraining the adverse impact of compounding. Large percentage losses require increasingly greater percentage gains to get back to even. Platt, however, points out a far less obvious reason for avoiding losses. Losing trades mentally impedes